Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm Gail Seiler, your host for today. Thanks for tuning in. We will long remember the weather of this past week, with the frigid and dangerous polar vortex that we experienced midweek, followed by the dramatic turnaround with temperatures warming to near 50 yesterday. And the rain quickly melted away most of the snow and brought a strange and eerie fog over the area. The coming week looks to be much less dramatic, but it will cool down again from the weekend. Today, we'll have a high of 32, and that will be early in the day, and then it will start getting colder. The drizzle will continue for part of the day, along with some wind developing. Tuesday will be in the 20s with light snow or freezing rain. Wednesday will be mostly cloudy with a high near 28 and a 40% chance of snow overnight, going down to around 15. On Thursday, snow is likely again with a high near 19. Friday will be mostly sunny with a high near 11. So we're back to kind of normal February weather, not too cold, but not like the weekend. I saw some interesting statistics about women in state legislatures that I wanted to share with our listeners. Nevada is the only state with over 50% women in their state legislature. It's 50.8%, and this is the first year it's been that. Colorado is next with 47% women. But Iowa has only 29% women in the state legislature, so we have a ways to go. So if you're interested in running, remember that the CAT Center at ISU is hosting Ready to Run to help prepare women to run for office. You can find information on that on their website. Later in the show, we'll have an interview with Al Hayes from the Iowa Justice Action Network, and we'll be talking with him about mass incarceration in Iowa. And Bronwyn Beatty Hansen from the Ames City Council will join us for her monthly visit. But first, coming to us from California, where I suspect it is a lot warmer, is Dennis Hart with the news.
Thanks very much, Gail. It's good to be back here, as always, on this Monday. Of course, the story everyone was talking about last week, the event that affected absolutely everyone, was the frigid weather triggered by the polar vortex. Temperatures dropped to record lows. A University of Iowa student died of possible exposure. The U of I, along with Iowa State, Drake University, and the University of Northern Iowa, all canceled classes for a time. Many local school districts also canceled classes, a few of them because district buses stalled in the frigid weather. Even the U.S. Postal Service suspended deliveries on Wednesday. The low temperatures even affected internet and cable services. And below-freezing temperatures also created a hurdle for blood donation facilities in desperate need of inventory. Weather forecasters issued repeated warnings about the potential dangers during a cold snap that an entire generation of Iowans had never experienced the likes of. All kinds of tips were issued to keep people and pets safe, to keep household pipes from freezing, and to keep vehicles running. By 4 a.m. Wednesday, Des Moines had surpassed 1965's record low of minus 17 degrees. The capital city hit 20 below zero, making it the coldest January 30th in the city's history, and just 10 degrees shy of the all-time coldest day on record in Des Moines, which was minus 30 in January 1884. Just in case you're curious, Mason City hit 28 below this past week, Waterloo hit 25 below, and Ames hit 22 below. Yes, last week was quite a week. Meanwhile, two dogs left outside in northeastern Polk County during last week's terribly cold conditions were removed and taken to a shelter. The shelter said the dogs, named Chloe and Sophie, had been chained outside and could not get to food, water, or shelter, except for a homemade doghouse and plastic crate. 22-year-old Rebecca Woods was charged with animal neglect. At the same time, the Des Moines Register reported that Iowa lawmakers were considering harsher punishment for people who abuse or torture pets. That bill was spurred by the case of Dustin Young, who operated a dog kennel in western Iowa where authorities found three canine carcasses and dozens of malnourished dogs and puppies last year. Also last week, Marshalltown police said a 13-year-old boy who had gone missing a couple of weeks ago and who was found dead a week ago died of blunt force trauma, apparently after he fell from a communication tower. Authorities said Corey Brown had climbed over a secure fence to enter the tower site, then climbed onto the tower and fell. The boy had left his home after a disciplinary discussion with his parents. Authorities said there was no evidence to suggest any criminal activity was involved. Also last week, Three people were killed and two others hospitalized after a head-on crash on Highway 59 in Defiance. A northbound minivan crossed over the center line, striking a southbound SUV head-on. Meanwhile, a Johnston man died after he was ejected from his car when it struck a light pole on Interstate 80. It took place west of the Merle Hay Road exit in Polk County. 31-year-old Joshua Peterson was heading west on the interstate when his car hit the pole. In northeast Iowa, a 28-year-old man died in a snowmobiling accident. Howard County authorities said Ross Wilson was riding alone when his machine rolled over on him. He lived in Cresco. State officials said 20 people had died in traffic-related deaths in January in Iowa, compared to 25 who died in January of last year. Meanwhile, a 47-year-old man died after he was shot last week by someone he was hunting coyotes with in northwest Iowa. 47-year-old Kirk Struve of Granville was struck by a round that investigators believe was fired from another member of his hunting party. In Poweshiek County, a judge set a September trial date for the man accused of killing University of Iowa student Molly Tibbetts. Christian Mahena Rivera's trial is set to begin September 3rd. The 20-year-old Tibbetts was found dead in a cornfield last August after a month-long search for her. In Van Buren County, a southeast Iowa woman was sentenced to 10 years in prison for letting her 2-year-old son starve to death. 25-year-old Angel Poole of Birmingham had pleaded guilty to child endangerment. Authorities say her baby boy weighed just a bit over 5 pounds when he died. Meanwhile, the adoptive cousin of Sabrina Ray, a central Iowa teenager who starved to death in May 2017, was sentenced this past Friday to 14 years in prison. 22-year-old Josie Ray Bousman of Perry had admitted she locked the 16-year-old Ray in a room unattended with two other girls. Sabrina Ray's parents were sentenced to prison a few weeks ago. In Des Moines, authorities said a man hijacked a bus last week, forcing the driver to drive downtown, in their words, like a maniac, and threatening to kill police officers. 25-year-old Abraham Ramirez of Des Moines allegedly directed the bus through downtown Des Moines to the police station on East 1st Street, where he was arrested without incident. The bus driver was not injured, and no other passengers were on board. In Urbandale, a police sergeant sued the police department for what he called abusive treatment. Sergeant Mark Jorgensen said he suffers from post-traumatic stress disorder following the ambush-style shooting death of Urbandale officer Justin Martin 3 years ago. Jorgensen claims he faced disability discrimination and harassment and that the department failed to accommodate him both before the shooting and afterward. In a strange court case last week, the Iowa Supreme Court affirmed a district court ruling that found damage to a West Liberty substation from electrical arcing, damage that occurred when a squirrel scampered onto a transformer, was not covered by the city's insurance policy. West Liberty argued that the damage should be covered because it was caused by the squirrel, but the courts held the arc caused the damage. In politics, Democratic U.S. Senator Sherrod Brown of Ohio spent several days in Iowa last week. He said he will decide whether to run for president next month. During his Iowa swing, Brown said his fellow Democrats are not talking to working-class families. And Democratic U.S. Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts will return to Iowa next weekend after she makes what she calls a major announcement in Massachusetts. Everyone assumes she'll confirm she's running for president. In other news, the Principal Financial Group of Des Moines warned workers to expect job losses this year. Principal reported its profits dropped by more than $500 million in the fourth quarter last year. The retirement services company is one of the biggest employers in central Iowa, with some 6,500 workers in the Des Moines metro area. Still in the world of business, a West Des Moines private equity firm purchased Maytag Dairy Farms, the nationally recognized maker of Maytag blue cheese. Midwest Growth Partners did not disclose details about its purchase, but said it was a major investment in the 78-year-old dairy. Maytag employs 40 full-time workers and 40 part-time and seasonal employees. Meanwhile, a popular pizza place closed its doors for the last time this past Saturday. Old Chicago in the Merle Hay Mall in Des Moines first opened at the mall 12 years ago. The Old Chicago in Ankeny will stay open. The closing came a few days after Des Moines officials approved a nearly $5 million development agreement with the owner of Merle Hay Mall to help reinvent the aging shopping center after the loss of Sears and Yonkers anchor stores last year. Also last week, Des Moines officials said whether or not residents approve a 1 cent increase to the sales tax in March will determine if the city raises its property rate by 30 cents or lowers it by 60 cents next year. That 90-cent swing in the property tax rate amounts to about $72 a year for the owner of a $150,000 home. Des Moines voters will decide March 5th whether to raise the sales tax from 6 to 7 cents per dollar in the city limits. A sales tax hike would generate around $37 million in its first year. Half of that money would go to property tax relief. The remaining amount would go toward a variety of projects, including flood mitigation, neighborhood improvements, and extended library hours. Also last week, word that 2 years after the Iowa legislature lifted an 80-year statewide ban on the sale and use of fireworks, there's an effort at the Capitol to give residents more opportunities to shoot them off by lifting any ban that communities have placed on the use of fireworks on July 4th. One component of the bill would expand where fireworks retailers can set up shop. In sports last week, the Iowa State's men's basketball team defeated West Virginia 93-68, then defeated Texas 65-60. Meanwhile, the women's team defeated Texas Tech 105-66, then defeated Kansas State 81-52. And yes, there was another basketball team in action last week, and I'd be remiss if I didn't report that the University of Iowa men's team defeated the number 5 team in the nation, Michigan, 74-59. One more note before I take off. You may or may not have remembered that yesterday, Sunday, February 3rd, was the 60th anniversary of a very big event in Iowa. A tragic event. February 3rd, 1959 was the date when a plane carrying three rock and roll stars and their Iowa pilot crashed into a frozen field north of Clear Lake. Buddy Holly, J.P. the Big Bopper Richardson, and Richie Valens died, along with pilot Roger Peterson. A 13-year-old boy was devastated because he was crazy about Buddy Holly. 12 years later, Don McLean wrote American Pie, an 8.5-minute piece that became one of the most celebrated and debated songs in popular music history. The song's lyrics included the words, "Something touched me deep inside the day the music died." McLean told the Des Moines Register recently that American Pie wasn't about Holly, but about the loss of American innocence. 60 years ago, yesterday. And Gail, that is our summary of a very busy and extremely cold week of news from around Iowa. But never fear, spring will return next month. In fact, as you may have heard, Punxsutawney Phil did not see his shadow this past weekend, which indicates an early spring, and which would be great if groundhogs could actually predict the weather. In any case, I'll be back in this seat way before spring. In fact, I predict I'll be here this coming Friday with a look at what's making news around Ames. I'm Dennis Hart, hoping we all have a great week.
Well, that'll be the day when you say goodbye. Yes, that'll be the day when you make me cry. You say you're gonna leave, you know it's a lie. Cause that'll be the day when I die. Well, you give me all your loving and your dirty loving, all your hugs and kisses and your money too. Well, you know you love me, baby. Still, you tell me maybe that someday, well, I'll be through. Well, that'll be the day when you say goodbye. Yes, that'll be the day when you make me cry. You say you're gonna leave, you know it's a lie. Cause that'll be the day when I die. You know it's a lie, cause that'll be the day when I die. Well, when Cupid shot his dart, he shot it at your heart. So if we ever part, then I'll leave you. You sit and hold me and you tell me boldly that someday, well, I'll be through. Well, that'll be the day when you say goodbye. Yes, that'll be the day when you make me cry. You say you're gonna leave, you know it's a lie. Cause that'll be the day when I die. Well, that'll be the day. Ooh, ooh, that'll be the day.
That was Buddy Holly's song, That'll Be the Day. Today is the 60-year anniversary of what is known as the Day the Music Died, the day of the plane crash that killed Buddy Holly, Richie Valens, and Big Bopper outside of Clear Lake, Iowa, where they had performed at the Surf Ballroom. That'll Be the Day was number one on the hit charts on that day in 1959. Many of us have heard the startling statistics about incarceration in the United States. For example, that the U.S. has the highest incarceration rate in the world. But something that many of us might not think about is people who are in prisons and jails in Iowa. So we now have on the phone Alan Hayes, who is with the Iowa Justice Action Network, a group that works to reduce incarceration in Iowa. Can you hear us, Al?
Yes, I can.
Okay, thanks for joining us. Let's start by telling us what the Iowa Justice Action Network is.
Well, we are a statewide network of citizens that are concerned about reforming the criminal justice system, and we have representatives in many communities across Iowa that work on this issue, and we do a lobby day every year. It's coming up here on Thursday, and then we also sponsor conferences and do other things to try to educate the public about these issues.
And how big a problem is mass incarceration in Iowa? What are the rates here compared to other places?
Basically, the trend in the prison population in Iowa mirrored the national trend by increasing about fourfold between 1970, roughly, and the mid-2000s, from about 2000 in 1970 in the state prisons to about 80. It fluctuates around 82 to 8400 right now, and I don't have the exact numbers in jail, but it's quite a few more than that.
And there are pretty significant racial and ethnic disparities, is what I've seen. Is that correct?
Yes, Iowa has one of the largest disparities in the nation between the percentage of the population, which is African American, which is around 2.5% roughly, to the percentage of African Americans in prison, which is about 23%.
Mm-hmm. So a pretty big disparity there.
Right.
What are the main issues that IJAN, or Iowa Justice Action Network, is concerned with and that you work on?
Well, we have several issues that we've worked on. One is sentencing reform. We feel like a lot of the sentences are much longer than need to be to deter crime. And we also are concerned with mandatory minimums, which means that a person is forced to serve a certain percentage of their sentence, like 70%, without any opportunity for parole. We're also concerned with mental health because a very large percentage of people in prison and jail have mental health issues. We're concerned with adequate funding and also with trying to move people out of the prison system into the mental health system. And then we're concerned to make sure that there's adequate support for people coming out of prison. You know, I mean, I think our main goal with incarceration should be to prevent future crime. And we don't need to be incarcerating people any longer than is necessary. Plus, we want to create the opportunity for successful reintegration so that people won't reoffend. And so that's why support services for people incarcerated and their families after they come out of prison are really important. And then finally, there's a coalition of a number of groups that are working to restore voting rights for felons, to get rid of the constitutional provision that denies them the right to vote. And the governor has come out in favor of this, and we looks like we may be moving towards a constitutional amendment on that. Of course, that's a slow process. We'd prefer to see the governor at some point do an executive order like previous governors and make it much easier for people to get their voting rights restored. But it is good that the constitutional amendment seems to be moving through the legislature at this point.
Al, we're hearing a little bit of feedback. Do you have the radio on or anything like that? No?
No.
Okay. Are you on speakerphone, perhaps?
No, I've got the computer on, but not that's all.
Okay. Well, now it's better. I think it just improved.
Okay. Good.
Okay. Great. So you said you have a lobby day coming up. When will that be?
Well, we're going to be at the Capitol on Thursday, February 7th. We'll meet at 11 o'clock in the upper lobby of the Capitol, and we'll be having lunch and a speaker at 11:30 in room 116. Mark Stringer, who's the executive director of ACLU, will be talking with us, and then we're going to fan out and talk to our legislators and hopefully highlight some of the issues that I've just been talking about. And we hope to get a number of people down there to help us out with that.
So let's talk about some of those in a little bit more depth. Right now, the efforts to restore the voting rights, as you mentioned, the Democratic governor that we had a while back had used a proclamation to restore voting rights, but then that was changed back. Is that correct? Can you give us the timeline of what's been happening with that?
Well, the governor is empowered to restore voting rights to people that have been convicted of a felony.
That's in our Constitution.
Well, it's allowed for in the Constitution.
Okay. Uh-huh.
So basically, both Governor Vilsack and Governor Culver basically declared by executive order that the voting rights restoration would be virtually automatic. So it was very easy for people to get their rights back. Then when Terry Branstad came in, the first thing he did when he got in office was to rescind that executive order. And he set up a process for voting rights restoration, which is very difficult. There's a lot of paperwork and so forth that has to be done, plus requiring that they pay off all their fines and restitution, which often takes many years for a person to do that. So then when we got the new governor in, she has expressed the desire to give people the opportunity. She says, you know, second chances are important.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but she loosened up the process somewhat for restoring voting rights, but still only a very few are getting them back, you know,
mm-hmm.
just a small number. But then she came out and supported this the constitutional amendment, which would solve the basic problem. The only problem with the constitutional amendment is it'll take about 5 years to make that happen, because it has to pass two legislatures, not
right.
sessions, but whole, and then it has to go to the voters, and so it could be a long time before that's taken care of. And then, so we would prefer that some more immediate action, in addition to the constitutional
mm-hmm.
amendment, we would prefer that some more immediate actions. And both the legislature and the governor can act on this. You know, the Constitution uses the words infamous crimes. Well, it's up to the legislature.
Mm-hmm.
Iowa Supreme Court has said it's up to the legislature to define what an infamous crime is. Okay, so they could define it. You know, you could say, well, capital murder, maybe that's an infamous crime, but you know, getting busted for selling marijuana when you're 18, maybe that's not an infamous crime. I think most people will agree that that isn't.
Mm-hmm.
So they could define what is an infamous crime if they really wanted to, and narrow the definition of it so that more people would get their voting rights back.
So you'll be lobbying for the long-term solution, but also hopefully a more immediate fix.
We're in coalition with several other groups on that.
Okay. And something that I heard more about a few years back here in Iowa, and then I haven't heard of recently, is the Ban the Box movement, as it's called,
mm-hmm.
where people would not be asked on housing applications and job applications about their criminal record specifically. Is there any movement on that?
No, I don't think that given the current composition of the legislature, we could really expect that. I think there's room for local governments
mm-hmm.
to act on that, and some local governments have passed ordinances. And remember, it's not that they can't ask about prior criminal record; it's that it can't be an automatic checkoff on an application. If you know, employers can still ask if. You know, at a certain point in the application process, when they're interviewing, they can ask. And again, if it's relevant, you know, if you embezzled and you're applying for an accounting job, you might say that's relevant. But it just can't be an automatic, you know, toss the application in the can thing if they check that box that says they've been convicted of a felony. And there's research that shows that very often those folks that are hired with the record are excellent employees, and the employer is very glad that they didn't automatically, you know, mm-hmm. put their application in the circular file because of that situation.
Yeah, and that would certainly affect the success that returning folks have when they're out of prison,
exactly.
whether they can get jobs and find a place to live. And I'm certain exactly. that affects recidivism and opportunity.
You know, in many ways, we make reentry very difficult for people. They're discriminated against in terms of their employment and their housing, and they face you know, we've been working with the Catholic Archdiocese on having support groups for returning citizens, and they the obstacles that they face are pretty unbelievable. And it's not a matter of, you know, I mean I think compassion is important here. We need to have compassion for our fellow humans, even if they have done something wrong. But I think it's just a matter of practicality. We want people to reintegrate so that they can, you know, get off the criminal path, lead successful lives and productive lives. And again, that should be the goal always of criminal justice, right mm-hmm. there.
Yeah. And a lot of that reentry support seems like it's provided by private groups and community organizations and churches, as you mentioned. Do you feel like there's adequate support coming actually from the system for people who are reentering?
You know, I think parole and probation officers, most of them really work hard, and they really want to see their clients succeed. And I mean, they're not perfect, and there's often, you know, issues. But so I think it's important that adult correctional services have an adequate budget. And in fact, their budgets have been trimmed over the years to the point where they're often struggling to have enough staff to really give the returning citizens the kind of guidance and attention that they need. But obviously, your private groups are important too. We have there's a group in Cedar Rapids called Living Beyond the Bars, and one of their leaders is a board member for us, and she works with families of people that are incarcerated. People often don't mm-hmm. realize the stress that occurs on families and kids when a person is incarcerated, and so. Her organization works to try to help those families get through a difficult situation.
And another of the issues you mentioned was mandatory minimum sentences. Are there specific things that you'll be lobbying related to that, lobbying for?
Well, in general, we'd like to see the discretion restored to, you know, to judges and parole boards. About sentencing, because each case is individual, and to have a flat out requirement that people serve a certain percentage of their sentence just it doesn't allow for us to look at things like risk, level of risk, what the person has done to try to change their lives. It's just a rigid system that really is I think it needs to be looked at again, and so we would advocate certainly substantial reduction, if not elimination, of mandatory minimums and some things have been done on that. The legislature a couple of years ago acted to reduce them for, I don't remember the exact felonies that they acted on. I think it was robbery, but they did act on that, and I think we need to, you know, I think the basic thing here is what Iowa has not done is what many states have done, and some of the states that have done this are the reddest states in the country, so we're not talking about a liberal conservative issue in many cases here. Iowa has not sat down and said, we have too many people in prison. Let's see what we can do to reduce that.
Mm-hmm.
And states like Texas, Georgia, South Carolina have done that, and they've substantially reduced their prison populations. But it just seems like we haven't had that conversation yet here in Iowa, and that's what we need to do.
And even at the federal level, there was that recent bipartisan criminal justice bill that had some of the kinds of changes in it that you've mentioned. But that was just for federal prisons, is that correct?
Yes. If federal prisons only incarcerate about 10% of all people in prison are in federal prison. The vast majority are in state prisons.
Mm-hmm.
That's why we work on this on a state level. And I was really glad to see Senator Grassley took a lead with the First Steps Act. He needs to twist some Republican arms here in the state, maybe to get something going. I don't know. But
well, maybe that bodes well for a slight shift in the way people are seeing things,
right,
even here in Iowa.
Yeah, I think so. And I mean, it's the impact of First Steps Act is somewhat limited. We'd like to see more in terms of getting, there are people sitting in federal prison for multiple decades for selling a small amount of meth or something like that, and it'll address that to some degree. But it's good that in this polarized environment, we're getting anything through Congress is difficult. I think it was really good that happened.
The bail system. There have been some municipalities and some locales that have made changes in the bail system, recognizing that it's pretty discriminatory towards people who have the financial resources to post bail, and other people can be in jail for a long time awaiting trial because they can't post bail, not because they're a risk. I know some places have tried to make changes in that recently. Is that something that's on the radar of anyone here in Iowa or a possibility?
Well, we haven't. IJN really hasn't addressed that issue,
mm-hmm.
but I think we need to. I think the national figures are that a very large percentage of people in jail are there not because letting them out would be a risk, but because they can't make bail. And, of course, you need to have some way to hold people accountable and get them back into court when they need to be. But I think some various places have experimented with different means of holding people accountable and making sure that they get back when they need to for their court appearance without forcing them to sit in jail for months and months and months and months just because they can't make the few hundred dollars that they need to get out.
And my last question will be, what can people do who are concerned about these issues?
Well, I think, they need to write their legislators, their state representatives and their senators. But certainly they can join up with us. All they need to do is email me at allen.hays@uni.edu. I'll put them on my distribution list, and they'll be apprised of what we're doing.
And does IJAN have a website or a Facebook page or anything?
Yeah, it's iowajusticeactionnetwork.org.
I've been speaking with Al Hays from the Iowa Justice Action Network. And thanks very much for joining us today and educating us on this important issue.
Well, thanks for inviting me. I appreciate it very much.
Next week on Local Talk, we'll continue to delve into these issues. I'll be speaking with Michelle Hines from an organization called Inside Out, and we'll hear about how that organization provides support for people returning from prison.
Phenology is writing nature's happenings when they occur. The first cicada of summer or the last flock of barn swallows in autumn are noted in a journal for future reference and comparisons from year to year. And as Lee Searles of Marshalltown writes, phenology is the study of natural cycles in the lives of living animals and plants. Today's phenology is about red-bellied woodpeckers. The large woodpecker with black and white checked back swooped to the feeder in the blink of an eye. The red from the nape of its neck really set off the profile of this rather handsome bird. It shifted its weight to perch next to a log with a series of holes and began hammering the frozen concoction within. The red-bellied woodpecker gains its name, red-bellied, from a rosy dusting of its abdomen in spring during its nesting season. You have to look closely to see the rosy appearance during spring courtship displays. Red-bellied woodpeckers are most common in mixed woodland forests, especially along rivers. They may be found in rather open areas such as forest edges and clearings, groves of trees in farm country, and shade trees in the suburbs. They nest in the decayed cavities of dead trees, old stumps, or in live trees that have softer wood such as box elders, maples, or willows. Both sexes assist in excavating their nesting cavities. Red-bellied woodpeckers have many varied calls. The males tend to call and drum more frequently than females, but both sexes call. The drum sounds like six taps. Often these woodpeckers drum to attract mates. They tap on hollow trees and even aluminum roofs, metal rain gutters, and transformer boxes in urban environments to communicate with potential partners. These birds mainly search out insect grubs under bark on tree trunks. They may also catch insects in flight. They are omnivores, meaning they eat insects, fruits, nuts, and seeds. Their breeding habitat is usually deciduous forests. In early May, the red-bellied woodpeckers begin breeding activities by drumming patterns such as slow taps followed by short, rapid drumming. Woodpeckers depend on dead and dying wood. The red-bellied woodpecker excavates holes in trees for nesting and roosting and can create a cavity for nesting in a matter of hours. The male red-bellied woodpecker takes the initiative in locating a site for a nest hole. He will then seek approval from his female mate by mutual tapping. Researchers have documented that red-bellied woodpeckers have the tendency to nest in clear areas with only few trees. Studies have indicated that closed canopy areas does not impact the bird's nesting behavior. However, further studies are needed and are in progress. Red-bellied woodpeckers are territorial during the nesting season, and they nest once per year. A pair breeding woodpeckers begins nesting in April or May, holding a year-round territories and showing high site fidelity, which is to say they stay in the territory where their nesting occurs. Areas around nest sites are marked with drilling holes to warn other woodpeckers away. By excavating these cavities, they play an important role in the forest community for other species as well. For example, critters such as squirrels and bats use these cavities for their homes, and songbirds like bluebirds, chickadees, and nuthatches will use cavities drilled by the red-bellies for their nests. It has been noted that vocal signals in red-bellied woodpeckers is usually attract and communicate with potential mates. In an intraspecific conflict, the red-bellied woodpeckers usually make a loud chirrack, 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 and woodpeckers drum with its bill during conflict situations and taps to maintain pair bonding. An example of a conflict event between red-bellied woodpeckers would be competing for the same mate. Nevertheless, the red-bellied woodpeckers are known to be in monogamous relationships. Hatchling babies have a high-pitched begging call, pre, pre, pre. They will continue to give a begging call whenever they see their parents for a while after fledging or leaving the nest. It has been said that red-bellied woodpeckers are noisy birds. The juvenile red-bellied woodpeckers are ready to fly or fledge from the nest at 24 to 26 days of age, and the juvenile red-bellied woodpeckers remain in that natal area or where they fledge for up to 27 weeks. Another nice trait of the red-bellied woodpecker, when setting up a bird feeder and watching for visiting birds at your home, quite often the red-bellied woodpecker is the first bird to come to the new feeder. It's like they are the scout of the bird community, and locating the source of the sunflower seeds is really quite a find in your songbird community. Oh, and that delectable concoction smeared into one-inch holes in a log is one part bacon grease to four parts cornmeal with enough peanut butter to form a ball. Woodpeckers love it, and that is our phonology for today about red-bellied woodpeckers in Iowa. Theme music is from John Barleycorn, Must Die by Traffic. This is Pat Schlarbaum with KHOI Community Radio, 89.1 FM, Story City, Ames. Without a little ball. This environmental update is sponsored by the Outdoor Alliance of Story County, Story County's Conservation's Friends Group, working to enhance outdoor recreation, education, and conservation. Information can be found at www.oasco.org.
You're listening to Local Talk on KHOI. Thanks for tuning in. I'm your host, Gail Seiler, and we've been joined in the studio now by Bronwyn Beattie Hansen, a member of Ames City Council. Thanks for being here, Bronwyn.
Thanks for having me.
On Saturday, the City Council held an all-day goal-setting meeting. What was that about?
Yeah, it's a meeting that we have, we've been having them annually, and actually this past year we had a check-in in the summer, too. But what we do is set goals for our time together. So we set two-year terms of goals when half of us are elected. And this year we checked in, updated the goals for what we could yet accomplish in 2019. It's usually sort of a sparsely attended meeting. It's not televised, though, you know, all of our meetings are open to the public to come to. So we had an audience of, I think, five or six folks there, which is great to see that people are interested enough to come watch us, because it is a important meeting, even if it's not well attended, because again, those goals really set what we do for the year. So they set our priorities, you know, that determines what we'll focus on or what we might push to the side. I was particularly excited. We did add an objective within the sustainability goal to evaluate and work to reduce greenhouse gas emissions within the city. And this is one of the things we probably got the most feedback about going into the goal setting session. We got asked to consider adding a climate action plan to our list of goals. And we didn't specifically add the climate action plan to the goals, but we did add funding a carbon inventory or greenhouse gas inventory, which is sort of the first step you need to do in order to do a climate action plan, to really understand where you are, you know, what your greenhouse gas impact is currently. So we're going to do that in 2019. I think that's an exciting first step forward. We talked about other goals, too.
What were some of the others? Can you give us a quick rundown?
Parking came up again, too, as it relates to Campus Town and Downtown. So one of the goals is strengthening Campus Town and Downtown. And so we're going to look at, you know, how we might modify parking in downtown. Of course, we're waiting on a parking study before we do anything on that. But to consider perhaps switching the meters and the lots, making the lots behind Main Street be metered, so to speak, and the front part be free for a time limit. Some different ideas. So those are some ideas that were suggested. Otherwise, though, we just kind of looked at our goals and decided which ones we were done with, you know, and could move on from, and which ones, you know, we had second steps to complete.
And what was one that you could kind of check off and say it was taken care of?
I mean, there are many, actually, different studies that we've completed about various topics. Oh, the pedestrian safety study was on our list of goals from last year, and we did complete that study. We've implemented a few changes. We want to go back now and see, you know, the effectiveness of those changes, but we were able to check that one off, you know, sort of done for the first round anyway.
This was basically a city council meeting, just very long, lasted all day. And so the people who were there were more watching the city council in action rather than, it wasn't an open forum or that kind of thing.
Right. Public input isn't allowed. It's not like a regular meeting in that there aren't points of business and different ordinances and things that were passing at that meeting. It is really more just
a working meeting.
Exactly.
Kind of
more of a workshop.
It basically covers relatively short-term goals, like a year to 2 years, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Not like the comprehensive plan that we're going to talk about next.
Right, exactly. The goals themselves, they've lasted for years and years. So, you know, the major topics, expanding sustainability or strengthening Campus Town and Downtown, those aren't likely going to change through the course of several years. But then the objectives and the tasks, those specific things that we want to get done in order to move the goals forward, those are what we're modifying on a yearly.
The other thing that's going on now is the comprehensive plan for Ames. First, tell us what that plan is. We had Susan Guiazda and Kelly Diekman on the show on Friday talking about it a bit. But remind us what that plan is, and then tell us about this, the events coming up.
Right. So the comprehensive plan, which you're seeing marketed as Ames 2040 plan, that is an update of our land use policy plan, which is something we've been wanting to do for a while now, and it's quite a long process. But it's an update of the land use policy plan, but they call it a comprehensive plan because it will bring in more plans than just what our old land use policy plan looked like. So it will incorporate things like our transportation plan and other plans that relate to land use. And so they'll all be brought in under one umbrella in this comprehensive plan. But it essentially, I mean, you could think of it as an update of our land use policy plan plus some.
Okay. And this is something that you want to have a lot of public input on and public participation.
Right. Because, as our land use policy plan is really what drives growth or what describes growth and change in the city over the next 20 years, so to 2040. If people are interested in how Ames is going to grow or develop as things change, this is the plan that guides that. So when we look at, where ideally to annex land or where to incentivize growth, or those are the decisions that are guided by a comprehensive plan.
And the last one was in 1997.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like it's time to, to do that again.
Exactly, yeah. And, the public input, like I said, it just is essential because the plan is very important. Ames, the shape of Ames in the future is directed by it. So we do, like you mentioned, we have a couple of public input meetings on the calendar in February. So the first of them is tomorrow. That's Tuesday, the 5th. From 3 to 5 p.m. Or from 6 to 8 p.m. You can pick a time slot. And that's at the library that's being held, that input session. And then we have one later in the month, Monday the 25th. And that's 5 to 8 p.m. Out at the Research Park. So if people are interested and can make those times, I would just highly encourage folks to give input.
And my understanding is people don't have to come for the whole time. It's informal, so people can come and chat with someone and give some input, but not be there for the whole 2 or 3 hours.
Right. Yeah, exactly. There'll be a way to gather input on a come-and-go basis. Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
And then, of course, input can be given online as well. Mm-hmm. So the city's website, you should hopefully see stuff on social media coming about how to give input on this plan too. So check out the website, check out the city's Facebook page for links to how to give input on that electronically.
And how is this plan used? For example, how was the last plan used?
Well, for example, a developer or landowner might come to us and request that their land be annexed. Perhaps they want to develop it into, say, a housing development or something like that. And if they are in a part of town that the land use policy plan says, yes, this is where Ames plans to grow, this is where our infrastructure can handle growth, then we might say, yeah, okay, you can annex, sure. And depending on how, the circumstances, we might even help provide services to an area if it's our preferred growth area in a land use policy plan. If it's not, say they want to annex a piece of land where our infrastructure doesn't reach, where we really didn't intend to put infrastructure for a long time, then we might turn down that annexation request. So that would be one way how it guides the growth of Ames.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And is there any, switching gears a mm-hmm. little bit, is there anything to update about the Healthy Life Center? Because we were hearing a lot about that last year, but not so much recently.
Yep. We just had an update on that on the 31st of January. We got together and we heard an update from the fundraising committee and the other, just all the entities involved. So the update was that the private fundraising goal for the Healthy Life Center, well, let me back up. The project total for capital costs to build is estimated to be about $48 million or so. And of that, the goal had been to get about $18 million in private donations, philanthropic donations. And so this was an update on where we were on that. And then it was also to talk to the other potential funders. So the City of Ames is estimated to put in $17 million. And again, this is all if the project goes as we saw it when the consultant presented it. Mary Greeley is hopefully in Heartland, Story County. So we met to talk with all these groups about how we're going to move forward, and really we need to have commitments from them soon to know what we're going to do, if you know, how to move forward. So the private donations are at about $6 million of the $18 million. And then we're hoping that the other entities, so Mary Greeley, Heartland, Story County, that they can all meet, you know, their various boards and stuff like that, meet and make a decision sometime in February or March so that we can decide what the city's contribution will be and how to proceed.
And is there a timeline, an ideal timeline of when it might start, if it's going to happen, the building?
Oh, good question. Well, it would take a bond referendum.
Okay, so that would have to happen.
Yeah, and so the ideal goal would be that we'd aim for that to happen, you know, late summer or so.
Mm-hmm.
And so then we'd see, you know, so then that's a whole other element, is the bond referendum as well.
Okay, and it also is the time of year when budget discussions are going on for the city.
That's true. This week we meet tomorrow and Wednesday and Thursday for budget overviews, and then we finalize things and wrap it up yet in the month. It's always a very interesting time as we consider our budget. Yep.
And before we went on the air, I was asking you about services, human services, and the importance of those, especially during the cold weather that we just experienced. And that's something that will be part of the discussion, is the funding of those kinds of agencies and efforts, right?
Right, yeah. I mean, exactly. Part of our budget is asset funding, which is the method that the city uses to fund human service agencies, along with other entities that help fund, too. And so we have that budget coming up to look at, and we increased funding to asset this year, as we have done for a number of years. And then we also have our second year of the Human Services Capital Grant program that the city has done, where we did allocate $250,000 for capital needs of human service agencies. You're right. The cold definitely has brought sort of an acute awareness to certain human service needs, but it's ongoing. Mm-hmm. You know, it's something we really think about year round too. But I'm proud of the funding we devote to human services in Ames. I think it's the asset method of allocating funds is really unique, and it's a great system. And I think we have a lot of good things going there.
All right, so lots going on and lots of ways for people to be involved and to have input.
Yes, always.
Okay, thank you very much. We've been speaking with Bronwyn Beattie Hansen, a member of Ames City Council, who comes in each month and keeps us updated on all of this. This is KHOI Community Radio, and you've been listening to Local Talk. I'm your host, Gail Seiler. Local Talk is broadcast on KHOI at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. on Monday and Wednesday, and 5 p.m. on Friday. You can also listen to our shows online at our website, khoifm.org. Local Talk was engineered by Cynthia McClure. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music we heard was by, I'm forgetting who it was, That'll Be the Day by Buddy Holly. Thanks to the other voices we heard on the show today as well. As always, stay tuned to KHOI, because coming up next is Democracy Now! And national news headline on Pacifica Radio. Remember that your participation as audience and supporter is what makes KHOI possible and meaningful. Thank you for listening, and see you again on the radio. Funding for KHOI Local Talk is provided in part by the Iowa State Center, presenting Cirque Mechanics, inspired by modern circus with roots in the heart of American ingenuity, February 4th at 7:30 p.m. More information can be found at center.iastate.edu.